Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green for edging us towards the weekend. It's Thursday, the 16th of September, and this is Game On. Coming up today, with the Ultimate Rugby Championship just around the corner, Bernard Jackman joins me in studio to look ahead to the action. Plus, there are plenty of GAA managers on the move. Colm Keyes will bring us up to speed. Conor Nyland will tell us all we need to know about the US Open champions, Emma Raducanu and Daniel Medvedev. Plus, what's next for Novak Djokovic? We'll also have Jeff Shepherd with us. He's going to cast his eye over all that's happening in the US. Now, if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
So welcome along. There is plenty going on in the world of football tonight as well, and it is very much focused on the Europa League and that new Europa Conference League. Celtic are currently in action. They're playing Real Betis and they have just gone 1-0 up. West Ham are also in action already. They're playing Dinamo Zagreb. There is 16 minutes gone there and it is a nil all. And for any Shamrock Rovers fans listening, Liam Scales is on the bench for Celtic, so we'll be keeping an eye on whether or not he does get his run tonight. Okay, we are going to start with Gaelic games. As I mentioned at the top of the show, there are a lot of manager movements at the moment. Colm Keyes is with us now to talk us through them all. Colm, how are things? Has the dust settled on a season for you? Are you still busy as always?
Still busy, Maria. I suppose all these things now, as you mentioned, all these managerial moves and are taking place. Some have already taken place. Obviously, Tipperary have got their vacancy filled in hurling with Colin Bonner, and in Wexford, Dara Egan is in there. So that's two. That brings the number, I think, of Tipperary managers to four. So there's a vacancy in hurling in Galway right now, and the deadline for that is due to close tomorrow evening, I believe. And obviously a bit of speculation around who might be there, but speculation everywhere, I suppose. In the absence of a transfer market in the GAA, the closest we can come to are managerial appointments to see who is going where. But so, obviously busy with that, Marie, and somewhere in the distance, at the end of October, I'd say around October 30, Saturday, there's a special congress that will ultimately decide what shape the 2022 championship is going to, the 2022 football championship is going to take. And that's a very important date in the calendar, given how recent championships have been going and the series of changes. So that's going to come quick. It was supposed to be this Saturday, but with the way events pressed on in the football championship, it was moved on. But an important date nonetheless.
Yeah, it is definitely looming. All right, but let's go through some of these appointments. And there has been even some today. Seamus McEnany is going to stay on as Monaghan's senior football manager. And I think when you consider just the All-Ireland final and how it went with Tyrone winning and the fact that Monaghan came so close to beating them as well, that it's no surprise really that he's staying on.
No surprise. And he probably entered his second year in a difficult spot after losing to Cavan the way they did, but having held on to their Division 1 status, beating Galway in a relegation playoff and then performing well in difficult circumstances that evening in Newry after the death of Brendan O'Go-Duffig, just within 24s of that, to beat Armagh, those circumstances, and then come so close. There are so many teams out there that have form lines through Tyrone that will be asking themselves, could that be us? I'm sure Donegal, who have beaten Tyrone in league and championship over the last number of years quite consistently, will be asking that question, and so too Monaghan. Maybe the difference is that when Tyrone get themselves in that position, they really believe. Tyrone are killers in that regard, and they have a very, very good record in All-Ireland finals over a long period of time, whether that's senior, minor, under 21, whatever it is. They have about a 70% return over the last 30 years in the modern age, shall we call it. So they normally get the job done in All-Ireland finals, and maybe that's the difference. But a lot of teams will look at that and say, could that be us? And it does provide a little bit of hope for the rest to maybe bridge those gaps.
Yeah, and I think Monaghan probably does bring us on nicely to Kerry when you think about it, Colm, especially because of the backroom team that is in place in Monaghan with Donny Buckley in there. Do we know if the backroom team is staying the same?
Well, I would think Seamus McEnany certainly hopes that the backroom team stays the same. But there was certainly a suggestion that Donny Buckley could be very interested in the Kerry job. I don't know whether we'd call it a vacancy. I presume it is. And the vacancy could still be filled by the outgoing manager, Peter Keane. But on Monday night, with Kerry's appointment establishment of a five-person committee to establish the next manager, they have clearly decided, well, our next appointment is going to be a more long-term appointment, in probably 3 years. That's generally what Kerry will settle for. So rather than extending Peter Keane's time by maybe a year and saying, well, let's go on for another year and see where you get with it, they've opened up the process. And that, to me, is comparable to the dreaded vote of confidence that a Premier League chairman gives a manager. It's not too long after that before they find themselves out of the job. This doesn't look great for Peter Keane. Notwithstanding that, Marie, he may still get back into the position. But Jack O'Connor is obviously, having vacated the Kildare job just a week or two back, Jack O'Connor is in a very strong position for his third coming as Kerry football manager. But maybe Donny Buckley will see this as his opportunity. He's been involved in two Kerry management teams in the past. He was with Jack O'Connor, left midway through 2012. He was with Peter Keane for a year and just a couple of months, and he left in early 2020, and he went to Monaghan, and he's gone down very well in Monaghan. They would like to hold on to him, but maybe this is his time. And Kerry is probably one of the few counties that could operate on a head coach basis. And again, there's a suggestion there that the former defensive great Seamus Moynihan could pair up with him. And I know Seamus and Donny Buckley, and indeed Tomás O'Shea, were very interested in coming together as an under-20 Kerry management last year. So there are obviously some links there. So interesting times. I'd put Jack O'Connor down as the favourite. I wouldn't rule out Peter Keane at this stage, and as a springer, maybe Donny Buckley.
And just on, look, as at the point you made there about the hope now that there seems to be around the country because of what Tyrone did and where they came from and the expectation that was on, or the lack of expectation really that was on them at the start of the season. Is inter-county management, football management now a little bit more attractive to people, do you think?
It is for certain positions, and obviously Kerry will always be among the most attractive, maybe the most attractive, because of the wealth of talent that is always down there. But obviously, look, Dublin are the strongest team. Having said that, it's a very difficult environment for a Kerry football manager. Even Mick O'Dwyer, he got 3 years after his last All-Ireland title in 1986, was his last All-Ireland title as manager, three more years, and in 1989 he moved on. Same for Paddy O'Shea, same for Jack O'Connor. 3 years is the credit line normally in Kerry. Eamon Fitzmaurice got four after 2014, and that to me puts Peter Keane on rather precarious ground in that respect. But yes, it probably does. I mean, the Donegal, we mentioned Monaghan, a few teams like that can obviously, and I often think that, you know, there is talent in Galway, but is the right culture there? They look across the border to Mayo and ask themselves, are we comparable to that in terms of athleticism? Certainly the talent is there, but is the whole culture around performance and all of that there? I suggest I don't think it is there yet.
And what about in Leinster? Like, there are a few vacancies. You mentioned the Kildare one there. Does it feel like it's a little bit more open now because of the maybe trajectory that Dublin are perceived to be on?
Yeah, and if you project forward and you look at the underage results that have been happening now, albeit Dublin reached two under-20 finals, so they still have a degree of talent. But is there a Conor Callaghan or a Kieran Kilkenny out there? I just don't see it at the moment. That's not to say that they could develop, but you could see Conor Callaghan and Kieran Kilkenny when they were minor and under 21. You could see those players were going to reach right to the top. There was little doubt about that. The underage results would certainly suggest that by the middle of the decade, Dublin will have come back considerably more to their Leinster rivals. I would think that, and I would think beyond that, Fenton, Kilkenny, Conor Callaghan, James McCarthy, axes, and already one of those pieces is gone, Stephen Cluxton, that you would say that these are the pillars of this Dublin team, and it would be very, very hard to dislodge them once these guys are around, because they're just born leaders in terms of crisis and all that. And although it didn't work out for them this year, they still took extra time to finish them off, and they were leading that game by so much at one stage. But I do think, yes, in Leinster, there is an opportunity for teams. Not next year, not even the year after, but in the mid to long term future, I do think. And you look at Offaly winning the under 20 All Ireland title, and Meath have won a minor title, having won back to back Leinster titles now, and they've won three of the last four minor titles. And if you know, if they can't produce something like that, if they can't produce a senior team out of all that can be really competitive in the future, well, then there's something wrong. Something has gone wrong somewhere, because even though there's nothing linear about good underage teams translating that into good senior teams, it just doesn't work that way, and it's normally individuals. I do think that there's enough there for both Kildare and Meath and Leinster to make ground in the coming years. Maybe not in the short term, but certainly mid-term.
Now, to hurling as well, Colm, because there has been a little bit of movement, or should I say actually at this stage, it's just things staying static, and that's in Kilkenny. And I think no matter what, when you see a manager in the current era extending his stay for a 24th season, it still catches the eye, even though it's Brian Cody, because it's such a long time. And at this stage, it's just rare.
It is. And you say rare, the only in the last 50 years, and even you could probably go back before that, and obviously there were managers in Cork and Kerry, Cork Hurling, Kerry, that were there a long time and came back in. So there's no real record for who was manager if you go back pre Mick O'Dwyer and Kevin Heffernan. But certainly in that era, the only comparable at this point is Sean Boylan, who had 23 years with Meath Football from 1982 to 1995, and now Brian Cody has gone beyond that. So that's a remarkable return. He was returned on Monday night within minutes of Peter Keane's, I won't say his fate has been sealed, but within the five-man committee being established with the announcement of that, Brian Cody had been appointed. And just the difference between Kerry and Kilkenny, whereas it's 7 years now, it'll be 7 years next year since Kilkenny last won an All-Ireland title, but there was apparently very little opposition. I think it was pretty much silence when he was ratified. It was just a matter of form that Brian Cody is back in now. And while there will be certain misgivings locally, you've got to look at, is there anyone else really capable of doing a better job? I think he's got a lot out of the current team, but obviously at a local level, there are some that think it's time for a new voice and to look at things differently. I do think, come this time next year, if Kilkenny haven't progressed at least to an All-Ireland final and performed really well, I think there will be a lot more stirring there.
Well, that's the problem with setting such high standards. You have to try and keep meeting them, and Brian Cody has certainly done that. Colm Keyes, thank you so much for joining me, and we'll talk again soon. 2FM.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Get back on track after summer with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Championship point.
Game set.
All hail the Queen of Queens. Emma Raducanu is the US Open champion.
Most of all, I would say thank you to everyone here, New York. Thank you all for making me feel so at home from my first qualifying match all the way to the final. I've loved playing in front of you, and you've really spurred me on in some very difficult moments, and I hope that me and Layla put on a good performance today.
Now, that was the voice of Emma Raducanu, who was catapulted into stardom over the weekend when she beat Leila Fernandez to win the US Open in the most thrilling style. I'm delighted to be joined on the line now by Conor Nyland. Conor, she really has entered a whole other world now of being a global superstar. Did you know about her before this weekend?
Hi, Marie. I did. She had a bit of a run at Wimbledon. It's easy to forget that, and it feels like a long time ago. But she did make the fourth round, and went off court. I think she was a set down against Tomljanovic, and didn't reappear. She had breathing difficulties, and Piers Morgan and Kevin Peterson and all these people on Twitter were having an opinion on her game. And then she went quiet again for a couple of months. She went out to the States, played some low-level challenger events, and everyone thought, she's definitely going to be a top 50 player, but she's going to take 2 or 3 years to sort of hit the, challenging frequency for the top 20. And off she goes from qualifying at the US Open and doesn't lose a set, and I think only taken to 7-5 in one of those sets. So it was one of the most unbelievable breakout performances we've ever seen in tennis, and it was just so much fun. And with Fernandez, this great Canadian on the other end of the court in the final on a free-to-air Saturday night, I think there was 9 million or so watching in Britain on Channel 4 on Saturday. So it was just awesome for tennis and an amazing, amazing story.
Yeah, it really was. Like, she is now the first British female winner at the US Open since Virginia Wade in 1968. The first qualifier in the Open era to win a slam. The youngest women's slam champion since Maria Sharapova at Wimbledon 2004. The youngest Briton to win a Grand Slam title. And the first woman to win the US Open without dropping a set since Serena Williams in 2014. So she's definitely arrived anyway, Conor. But is it sustainable, do you think? Are we going to see her now for the next couple of decades?
Well, that's the interesting one, because you look at a Serena Williams and she's 40 and she's been out there since she was sort of 15. But she hasn't had, she didn't have to contend with the whole the social media element and the all that extra attention that I think is on the players these days. They could sort of disappear a bit between Grand Slams and the world's focus would come in on them every 2 or 3 months. But it feels like it's going to be a little bit more of a spotlight just with the way the world is now, and we know what the British media are like. So I think it'll be difficult for her to block a lot of that stuff out, but she does seem to have a really good team around her. But yeah, she's a sort of a marketer's dream. She's fluent in Mandarin. She's you know, English speaking. She's got to appeal to so many different markets. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see, can she sustain that? And we saw with Coco Gauff a couple of years ago, winning, I think it was third or maybe fourth round of Wimbledon as a 15-year-old. And she has certainly progressed up the rankings, but it's not like she's turned that into dominance. Now, she's still only 17. But it doesn't necessarily, what Emma Raducanu's done in the last 2 weeks is incredible, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to, say, dominate tennis for the next 10, 15 years. Perhaps she can. She's got an unbelievable game. It's going to be very interesting to see, and there'll sure be a lot of interested parties looking at her at Wimbledon next year. You know, there'll be an awful lot of pressure on her, so that'll be fun every year for the next few years watching her try and bring it home on the women's side, like Andy Murray did in the men's.
You're piling the pressure on her now already. But look, you did mention what happened at Wimbledon there, and look, it was an incident, and there was a lot of question marks on her about her afterwards, and a lot of pressure as well. But what she seemed to do is she seemed to come away from it and learn from it as well, and she was able to deal with whatever was thrown at her. And especially in the final, when she had that when the blood was pouring down her knee, she didn't get fazed at all. She was just able to continue on and get on with the job in hand.
Yeah, I thought the Fernandez match was going to be really, really tricky for Fernandez. Is essentially the same age. She turned 19 last week. So, you know, often when you're playing somebody a couple of years older, the pressure can be off and expectations are down. And then all of a sudden, when you play somebody your own age, it can be a little bit more difficult psychologically. So I thought that was going to be interesting. Plus the fact that Fernandez seemed to kind of have the crowd on her side, certainly at the very start, and definitely by the end of Fernandez's runners-up speech, she'll definitely have them on her side next year. So she's quite a lot of charisma as well. So to have the two players going at it, I thought Fernandez was going to be a really tough out, but she couldn't hurt Raducanu. Raducanu's movement is so smooth, and her ball striking was incredible with all that pressure on her, because Fernandez takes the ball so early. She stands right on the baseline, takes time away. But Raducanu sort of absorbed that in the first few games. And I think Fernandez sort of ran out of belief early in the second set. And she's one tough cookie as well. So, you know, I think we'll be seeing a lot of hopefully those two over the next few years.
Yeah, it's great just to see that kind of next generation of talent coming through as well, and just for people to have eyeballs on it and to see the game and to fall in love with it and keep it in the consciousness. And, you know, everybody talks about can't see, can't be, and the importance of seeing these young girls and women on the big stage achieving success, and they're right there doing it. And it's just, look, it was a great sight over the weekend.
Well, the viewership for the women's final was higher than the men's final in the US. On Sunday, I think the Djokovic Medvedev match got maybe 2.1 million and Raducanu Fernandez got 2.7, something like that. So yeah, you're already seeing that they're more than holding their own, which is great to see.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the Wimbledon, I'm looking forward to Wimbledon now next year, and why not? You see all the people out on the road with their rackets and playing and all the rest. But look, let's talk about Medvedev. Well, probably we should talk about Djokovic first, which I know is not the right thing to do, but the story leading into the game was about whether or not he was going to have that calendar Grand Slam, and also bypass Federer and Nadal in the battle to finish with the most men's majors. but he wasn't able to do it. And was that down to him or was it down to what Medvedev brought?
He was definitely tight, but Medvedev, even on any given day, Medvedev at the moment is playing pretty much as good as we've seen anybody play the last 10 years. He's 6'6". It's hard to kind of believe, but he moves like somebody 6'1". He serves over 130 miles an hour, and then he's got these weird strokes, but he manages to take the ball out in front of him and get himself on the front foot and hit incredible depth, just like Djokovic does. So he's a real handful, but I definitely think Djokovic, the occasion got to him a little bit. Medvedev was actually going for huge second serves early on as well. So Djokovic is known for his return of serve, and Medvedev wasn't giving him any rhythm. He was making a lot of first serves, and on the second serve, he was just going after it like 126, 127 mile second serve. So Djokovic just couldn't get a handle on it. And then, you know, the enormity of it and what a big year it's been, and going out to the Olympics and not getting it done, and then coming to New York and trying to do this. And it was amazing that this story was completely secondary to the women's in tennis and in the wider world, that Djokovic was going for this thing that a man hasn't done since 1967, a player hasn't done since Graf in 88. And yet, you know, people were kind of half not paying attention. Obviously, you know, tennis geeks were, but the wider sort of casual sporting fan was sort of watching it, but it was more wrapped up in what was happening on the ladies' side. So he seemed to win the crowd over at the end. He got, you know, the head was in the towel, and he shed a few tears, and I think that actually won over the New York crowd. So perhaps he's just won too much, and people haven't liked him over the last 2 years for a variety of reasons. But I think it actually makes next year even more interesting, because Nadal, Federer and Djokovic are all on 20 slams still. And, you know, Djokovic is going to be there. Nadal is potentially going to be there. The French is a real challenger. But then you've got Medvedev and Zverev. So potentially the three lads could end up on 20 each forever, which would be kind of hilarious. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think it makes next year even more interesting, the fact that he's still trying to get out in front.
Yeah, look, what I took away from that game was, one, the emotion that he showed, because, like, he gets angry and all the rest, but it's very rare that you kind of see the tears. And just when the crowd, as you mentioned, got behind him, which they don't seem to do in New York too often, but they did. And he just seemed to really respond to that in a way that we're not used to seeing. You know, that time that he kind of shouted up at them, and you could just see it in him that he was enjoying, or just maybe responding to the fact that they were behind him. And he must be a little bit aware that, you know, he's not that well liked out there.
Yeah, I think he's acutely aware, to be honest. I think he probably spent too much time thinking about it. And what I was amazed by was his comment when it was finished. He said, "I feel relieved after he lost the match." You know, this guy's just trying to go for tennis history, and he says, "I'm kind of glad it's all over this year," where he probably has just been thinking about it all day and all night. You know, can I create history here? Because he's obsessed. You know, he has to be to get to that level. So it's been a long year for him, so he's going to have to go off and lick his wounds and be ready for Australia next year. But yeah, going back to his on court, he actually took a swipe at a ball. There's a couple of TV angles that captured it, where there was actually a ball girl coming out to collect the ball. Djokovic kind of wound up as if to hit it and actually stopped himself, and the ball girl flinched. Now, I don't know how I sort of saw it on Twitter. There's a few kind of gifs going around about it, but he nearly, you know, got himself in an awful lot of trouble again. So he just needs to be careful on that. And hopefully, I'd love to see Nadal get after it at the French Open next year and potentially get another one and put some pressure on Djokovic. But it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I wonder if he's going to end up being one of these guys who comes to the end of his career, one of these athletes, and just decides that he wants everybody to love him, because he was just the way he spoke after the match as well, talking about how the crowd had touched his soul and he never felt anything like that, and, you know, saying I love you to the crowd. So I'll be keeping an eye on that over the next few years. Conor Nyland, thank you so much for joining us, and we will chat to you again soon. We're going to take a very quick break, and then it's rugby.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. There are a lot of goals in the Celtic Real Betis game. It's only 44 minutes in and it is 2-2. And West Ham have also scored. They are leading Dynamo Zagreb 1-0. It's time to turn our attention to rugby now. And Bernard Jackman is with me in studio. Bernard, it's rugby season. Well, it's almost rugby season. It is upon us. The URC was launched yesterday and it gets on underway very, very shortly. Connacht, Munster and Leinster's opening round games will be broadcast live on free-to-air television, and also Munster's home game against South Africa newcomers Sea Sharks will be live on RT2 and on the RT player on the 25th of September with a 7:35pm kickoff. Is everybody now going to get into the URC, get behind it? Is it going to be different to the Pro 4? Is there going to be a lot more positivity about it now, do you think?
Yeah, I think there will. I actually think this is the format that we've been waiting for. The Pro 14 has been criticised and ridiculed to a certain extent over the last, probably since inception. And I think with reason. But I do believe they have got closer to finding that correct format, and how it works is it's four regional pools, the Irish together, the Welsh together, South Africans together, four in all of those, and the last one is Italian and Scots joined up, and it's a top eight. There's only one conference, whereas last year we had two conferences. The top eight go into the playoffs with one playing eight, and the top four obviously getting home advantage, and the South Africans can qualify for Europe as well. So it's going to make it more competitive for sure. And the Irish, let's be honest, we've had our own way to a certain extent in this. I mean, all four Irish teams are in the Champions Cup next year. That won't happen this year because each pool is guaranteed someone in it. So, and the South Africans being in it, and that level of, I suppose, fairness in terms of a straight top eight qualifying for Europe, I think will make games at the end of the season competitive, whereas there has been dead rubbers as teams couldn't qualify. So I think it's exciting. Dwayne Vermeulen announced this morning as an Ulster player is a massive, massive coup for them. I pride myself on knowing what's going on totally out of the blue. And I was looking forward to watching him play for the Bulls. You know, he's an unbelievably good player. Obviously, he's at the other end of his career, but still incredibly effective and great signing by Ulster, who obviously lost Marcel Coetzee last year. So that's a positive for Irish rugby for sure.
Okay, so let's have a look at those South African teams, Shark, Bulls, Stormers and Lions. How good are they? How competitive are they going to be in this league?
Look, at it. I think the Bulls are very good. They just won the Currie Cup. They have two huge backers behind him. Jake White, obviously won a World Cup at South Africa, has been very, very active in the recruitment market over the last 2 years. And in fairness, like you would say, oh, they lost Dwayne Vermeulen, but they brought back Marcel Coetzee. They're very, very strong. The Sharks are next best. And the Lions and Stormers, to be honest, are in transition. The Lions were, you know, won a Super Rugby about 4 or 5 years ago, but they aren't in great shape. And I think the worrying thing for me is they're missing their box at the start of the season. I would have loved to see, you know, the Sharks and the Bulls, etc., coming to Limerick and Dublin fully loaded with their box. But that's the nature of it. They won't come back in until after the Rugby Championship. But I do think that particularly the Sharks and the Bulls will be competitive over here. The Lions and Stormers might take a little while. But over there, all four will be very, very hard to beat. And that's really important, you know, that we have to fight for points, and that anybody can beat anybody, and that hasn't been the case up till now in this competition.
And what about the Irish provinces then? So you mentioned Vermeulen in Ulster and the difference that he is going to make. Something that Dan McFarland said that was quite interesting as well was that the thing that they can possibly find a little bit of an edge is fitness, and they have brought Mikey Kiley up from Limerick to try and change what they need to change and to get that little bit extra.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually was talking to Jordy Murphy earlier, and he said there's been a huge focus on fitness for them this pre-season. They felt, like, let's be honest, they were the second best Irish province in terms of running Leinster close, and to beat Leinster, and Jordy said this today, you effectively need to be fit enough to play for 80 minutes. And Ulster found, when they reviewed their last couple of defeats against Leinster, that they had little moments where in the game where they weren't able to stay. Their engine wasn't big enough to stay with Leinster. So there's obviously tactical and technical things to figure out. But I think they have put a huge focus on that. Dwayne McFarland wants to play is high tempo. That's the way the game is going. Bar international level, obviously the box show that you can win in other ways. But the game is now about high fitness levels, ball in play for incredibly long periods of time. And I think Ulster, you know, bringing bringing the expertise in from Limerick is a, you know, is a sign that they're chasing, they're chasing and investing in that area.
So Leinster were able to use 57 players when winning last season, which is a testament to their strength in depth and probably also a sign of what the Pro 14 was about last year. Do you think that this year they're going to approach it a little bit differently?
No, actually, those days should be gone, really. And this is another reason why I like this new format. There's less clashes with international rugby. And for example, you know, there's a break in November when Ireland are playing. So in theory, you should have your international players a lot more. And I think they would be needed. So, yeah, it's not great for the fringe guys. You know, the guys from number 35 to 57, they may not get as much game time. But let's be honest, as fans, we want to be seeing the Jordan Larmers, the Gary Ringroses, the Gavin Coombs play for the province on a weekly basis. And I think this format, it won't be perfect. There will obviously players will need to get rest. But in general, I think the stronger sides will be out more often.
We also want to see really competitive interpros though as well, and we didn't get a lot of that last year, and Munster will probably get the blame for some of that. Do you think that this year they're going to be more competitive when they try and take on Leinster?
Look, I think it'll be a function of how they're tracking in the URC in general. So I think a lot of this stuff is negotiable, and it's a case for, you know, Leo Cullen or Johan van Graan to flag to Andy Farrell, look at, you know, we're third in the log. I need to play my strong team there. And I think from an Irish fan's point of view, if there is rest periods needed, which there obviously will be, that we don't do it when we're playing against each other, that we really hype up. I mean, we're coming out of pandemic. You know, finances are much needed. Let's play our best internationals against each other, Munster v Leinster v Connacht v Ulster, and, you know, get those stadiums full again. And let's see, like the Irish team as well. I mean, I think there's a lot of positions up for grabs in the Irish team. So let's test these like old-fashioned Irish trials where they get to play each other more regularly.
It was interesting to just be following the coverage over the last few days. And when it came to Munster, a lot of it was focused on Stephen Larkham and the game plan that he was playing. And it felt like that it had to be defended almost.
Yeah, it is. It's weird because you know, Munster under Rob Penny went away from that traditional game, and then, you know, a lot of people regretted that maybe didn't give him more time to do it. Larkham's come in, and it probably hasn't been that real exciting brand of rugby that the fans are waiting for. I'm sure he's under a little bit of pressure. I think the key is having, you know, Joey Carberry there. We got to see him at the end of the season, and they looked much better already. They've got three very good young tens. I would be shocked if this season, with a full pre-season behind them, with Joey back, if Munster don't open up a little bit and play with a better brand of rugby. But having said that, you know, people, when they think about Larkham, think about the player he was. As a coach, when he coached the Brumbies, they were very pragmatic, you know. So we're not sure that his vision of the game is this free-flowing, you know, all-out attack. Certainly what he did in the Brumbies and what he's done so far at Munster would lead you to believe it isn't, that he's very much focused on a kicking game, etc. But I do think Munster now have a back line, and I think there will be, as I said, an evolution in their game. And I think the pre-season he's had with Joey not being away, I think, you know, I expect to see them be a lot more ambitious early doors.
Connacht, there's been a lot of upheaval there. It's probably hard to gauge really how things are going. But are you confident that they will be able to compete adequately in this new league with the new teams?
Yeah, it's going to be tough for them, I think. Their pre-season friendlies have been a little bit worrying, even though obviously, you know, it depends what you want to get out of those games. But taking a lot of points against Worcester and London Irish is worrying, particularly because they were a team last year who, when they were slightly off, conceded 40, 45 points, you know, and that's going to be a big issue. Their defence coach has now become their attack coach. They have a new forwards coach, Dewald Senegal, who I know well, and you know, he's working hard there, and he's happy with how they're going. I think the biggest problem for Connacht is depth, and I think that they would have picked up points previously when the internationals were on. and there was fixture clashes. So that's worrying for them. And you know, I'd love to see Connacht continue to improve. I think Andy Friend's a great coach. There's some really good players down there, but possibly it's going to be harder for them to get those softer points they got sometimes when the opposition were away. And if they do get injuries, they don't have the same depth as everyone else. And the reason they don't have the same depth is they don't have the same budget. I mean, it's not by choice. It's just literally they're the poorest funded team in Ireland.
Now, there are going to be some new laws. They were trialled in the Rainbow Cup. Just given what we saw in the Rainbow Cup, do you think that there is going to be much of a change to the game? Are they going to make much of an impact?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think the one that's most... There's two big ones. Is the 50-22, which means any kick that you kick inside your own half that bounces in the opposition 22 and rolls out is a line-out for you. So, I mean, it's a massive reward, a momentum swing. You're in your own half and you find touch in their 22 and you get the line-out, which we know leads to a lot of points. So that's one. The reason for that is obviously to have those big momentum games, swings in games, but also to try and take players out of the front line defensively. So defending team will be more paranoid about that happening, which will hopefully free up a little bit of space. And the other one is the goal line dropout. So if you get held up over the opposition try line, it used to be a scrum five, and you know, and you're still on attack. Whereas now, if you get held up over the opposition goal line. It's a goal line dropout for the opposition. So effectively, the ball's probably landing back on the 40 and you go again. Now, why is that interesting? It's because a lot of us got sick of this relentless pick and go near the line. And, you know, effectively, if you go for that try and you get held up, it's turnover. So that will that make coaches a little bit more ambitious, and will they go to wit a little bit earlier? I think they have to, because I mean, you know, the game had gone where if they got field position, they could be there for 5-6 minutes, and then they have a penalty advantage, and then it goes back to the penalty and the pick and go again. So I like the law changes. I've watched them in Super Rugby, I've watched them in the Rugby Championship, and I think they are making the game better, which is what the goal is.
Yeah, exactly. Look, we're also in the middle of the Women's World Cup qualifiers, but unfortunately, the way things go, the focus is still very much on what happened at the Interpros last weekend, the very inadequate changing facilities that the Connacht and Ulster players had to use, and I would actually say probably had to endure, really, when you look at the video that was doing the round. Stacey Flood and Sam Monaghan, Ireland internationals, were asked about them today, and you know, Sam was actually quite strong, and I was surprised that she was quite strong on it, because it is difficult for players to speak out. But she said, we need to be treated better so that we can play better. And it's even just interesting to hear those words coming out of an Irish player's mouth, because we hear so little from them when it comes to issues like this.
Yeah, massive admiration for her, because one, it's very difficult to speak out when you're in that bubble as such, and you're worried about it's not employers in this situation because they don't get paid, but you're worried about the people who select you for your country. And then secondly, and this is something I thought about today, you know, after a defeat, and it was a poor defeat against Spain, you know the right thing to do is to talk up, but you kind of feel that shame of having lost as well. And you don't want to be seen as, you know, being out there talking about something else when you feel the criticism or the finger we point at you saying, why aren't you concentrating on beating Italy? So I really admire them. It's going to come not just from the players themselves. It has to be a collective approach from everybody who's passionate about Irish rugby and who wants fair play and who wants proper structures and support for our players. It's a game that needs help to develop. You know, it's in its infancy, because we haven't capitalized on good teams in the past. But I think the RFU, as a governing body, they need to get behind this, and not the hashtags and stuff is nonsense. I mean, that's the cream, you know, or the icing on the cake. It's what's actually the key ingredients to develop the game and support women's rugby in Ireland.
Where do you think that their male counterparts come into this? Because look, we did see Gary Ringrose talking a little bit about it. Johnny Sexton didn't say a whole lot. He said he didn't really know the ins and the outs of it. Do you think that there is a bit of a responsibility on them? Because they are the stronger voice in this. I did read a line from a podcast that you were on earlier, and the line said that, you know, it's everybody's sport. It's their sport too, and they should care a little bit more. Do you feel that they should use their voice? And also, can they use their voice, or are they in a difficult position?
I think some of the really established ones can use their voice. I mean, you know, they're not, they won't get dropped for this. I think it's harder for one of the women in the squad to talk up. And look, I'm not going to say it's them, it's the media. I think it's everybody. It's anybody who's passionate about proper facilities and support for women's sport. If it happened to the hockey, you know, one of the men's rugby players should be able to say that's not good enough. You know, it shouldn't just be rugby, because it's completely unacceptable. And like, in some ways, it's disillusioning, because in some ways you see so much change and focus on it, and then you think that you've turned a corner, and then you see that, and you know, you hear some of the stories, and you just wonder, is it just camouflage? Is it just, you know, PR? And it shouldn't be PR. As I said, I think the PR stuff should be on the end of some, you know, really strong planning, momentum, work in the grassroots. And I don't know. I mean, like, if you look at the performance end of it, which obviously we've got paid people to do, we're not hitting any of the metrics that, you know, are targeting. I mean, it's embarrassing. But then at grassroots level, there's not a proper plan. People feel disillusioned. This has to be the day or the week that people say enough. And like, I don't believe in an inquiry and stuff, and we find out in a few months. Like, it's pretty quick to find out what happened. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
a phone call could tell you that.
Sam Monaghan said 11 words today, and I think those 11 words, "We need to be treated better so we can play better," tell you all you need to know about the situation that those women's rugby players are in. Okay, Bernard Jackman, thank you so much. We're going to take a very quick break, and then it's American Sports. 2FM.
Game on 2FM. With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, the second halves have just got underway in the early games in the Europa League. Celtic are still drawing 2-2 with Real Betis, while West Ham are still leading Dynamo Zagreb 1-0. It's time now to turn our attention to American sports, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Jeff Shepherd. Jeff, we're going to start with golf, and Brooks Koepka has been getting a bit of a hard time because of things that he said in an interview with Golf Digest about the Ryder Cup. He says it's different, it's hectic, it's a bit odd. He said he likes to take naps a lot. He's not really getting those naps in. He's not been able to chill out on the couch and watch Sports Center like he usually does. And I have to say, I feel a bit sorry for him, because everybody likes a good nap when they can. And when they're taken away from you, I can see why he would miss them.
Yes, I mean, who doesn't love a nap? I mean, they're phenomenal, and you always feel better after you get one. Yeah, I mean, it's an odd, some odd things that he was saying. And aside just from all of the nap talk, you know, he's saying stuff about how difficult it is to go from the mindset of, you know, kind of being on your own and, you know, playing tournament golf as you do every week, and then all of a sudden you have to turn around and be on a team. Now, look, I mean, there is some validity to that point, but everybody who's ever been involved in the Ryder Cup has had to do this, and I don't know why all of a sudden it's a problem for him. He must really not want to be involved in this tournament for some reason, and, you know, to be saying all of this. And I mean, you know, we know he's got his issues with Bryson DeChambeau and other things like that, and he is coming off of an injury, but yeah, this is just odd comments to be made, you know, on the eve of the tournament.
There are some people, including former US Ryder Cup captain Paul Azinger, suggesting that he should just give up his spot, give it to somebody who actually does want to play, because those comments, as we outlined a little bit earlier, suggest that he's not that bothered about serving his country. What's the feeling in America about whether or not Brooks Koepka should go to Whistling Straits? He hasn't even gone there yet, actually. Everybody else is there and they're finding their feet and settling in, but he hasn't made it yet.
Right. And look, I mean, is the American team better if he's there? I would say, you know, most of the time, yes. But if he doesn't want to be there and he's not actually into it, look, you know, I mean, we've talked on this show, you know, many years now about the success that Europe's had over the U.S. and some of the struggles that the U.S. has had, and why has it always been like that? Not always, but why has it been like that more times than not? And look, I mean, the European players just seem to pull together more in that, you know, in this tournament than the American players have. It doesn't happen all the time like that, but it seems like that's kind of what happens more times than not. And to just kind of come out and just say some of this stuff really just kind of puts it out on the street, maybe what everybody's thinking, but now it's actually being said. So, I mean, if that's the attitude that he's going to have, and look, Azinger knows, I mean, more than anybody, obviously, what it takes to win a Ryder Cup. You need everybody rowing in the same direction, and it doesn't really sound like that's the case going into it. So it seems like, how would the U.S. really even have their best shot going forward if the players aren't all on the same page?
Now, he was injured, of course, ahead of that recce to Whistling Straits and has declared himself fit. But still, I mean, he probably should have went for the team bonding. But look, maybe himself and Bryson DeChambeau are actually vying for the headlines, because when you think about what Bryson said in the last few days as well, we all know now that he's heading for the World Long Drive Championship after the Ryder Cup, and he's been practicing a lot for that and like hurting his hands doing it as well, which seems a little bit crazy.
Yeah, so, you know, he wants to go in this long drive competition. And look, I mean, obviously he's a big dude and he hits the ball very far. But I don't, you know, and he's talking about how he wants to compete on this level of, you know, both on the PGA and in the long drive competitions. To me, it's almost kind of like I want to play in the NBA, but I also want to be on the Harlem Globetrotters too. You know, like I don't understand, like you're doing it. Like you are on the tour. You are one of the best golfers out there. I mean, that is where it all happens. The guys that are in the long drive competition would probably kill to trade places with you. I don't understand, unless it's just something that he really, really is, you know, he just wants to do for fun. But I would think at some point it's going to have to compromise your game. I mean, the attitude of just hitting it as hard and as long as you can. I mean, you obviously can't do that on every hole on a golf course. So, I mean, it's obviously something that he's known for, and maybe he thinks he can get, you know, better at this one thing and maybe it'll help his game. But it just seems to be, you know, odd to me. Those two skill sets and those two tours, or I won't even say tours, but those two type of things are just at odds with each other.
Well, to make a comparison over here, it sounds like somebody who is playing in a All-Ireland final but is more worried about the Puck Fada, which is coming up after it, which is a Irish version of a long drive competition, a hurling version of a long drive competition. You should check it out on YouTube sometime. Okay, let's move on now, because the NFL is back and it wasn't without its drama, and we probably really should start with Aaron Rodgers and how maybe his drama has affected his team.
Yeah, look, you know, well documented. You can just go listen to our podcast from all summer. You know, we talked about this, if not every week, every other week, about what was going on with Aaron Rodgers and where in the world was he and what game show was he hosting and all that. And look, the Packers showed up last weekend. They were going to play the Saints. They played in Jacksonville because of Hurricane Ida and damage to the Superdome. And then, not really the Superdome, but in the city of New Orleans. And the Saints beat the Packers 38-3. And it was an unbelievably bad performance by Rodgers and the rest of the Packers offense. And Jameis Winston clearly showed that, you know, he's got the skills to still be an NFL quarterback. And after the game, you know, Matt LaFleur, the Packers coach, is talking about how embarrassing this is. And we were outplayed and it was just awful. And Rodgers just says, hey, you know what? It was one game. I was bad. We'll get better. They just don't seem to be all on the same page up there. It's just a stunningly poor performance. I mean, probably the worst of his career. You know, no touchdowns, two interceptions, just out of sync the entire game. The Saints defense was all over him. And they have to turn it around pretty quickly. They're going to take on the Detroit Lions Monday night. It's a division game. The Lions are not very good. If the Packers don't win this and kind of win this one going away, they're going to need to start sounding the alarms.
How important is it to get that good start? Like, we saw the Patriots coming up short against the Miami Dolphins as well. But just in terms of momentum and how the season plays out, does it have a huge impact if you don't start winning early on?
Yeah. So look, Marie, now one of the things we have to keep in mind all season long, they've added one extra regular season game this year. So there are 17 regular season games, but typically in the, you know, the history of the league recently with the 16 game regular season, the teams that start out 2-0 have just an exponentially higher chance to make the playoffs than even the teams that start out 1-1. You start out 0-2, I mean, you're talking about having to win basically, you know, 10 out of your last 14 games to make the playoffs, and it's just a lot harder to do. I mean, it's a numbers game at that point, you know? Not to say that it can't be done, but you just make it a whole lot harder on yourself starting out behind that eight ball if you go 0-2. And so, I mean, it is critical that some of these teams, you know, we talked last week about Cleveland and Buffalo trying to get over the hump and do some things that they haven't really done in the last 20 or 30 years. They both blew late leads. Buffalo losing to Pittsburgh, Cleveland losing to Kansas City late in that game, and they had that one won. And so if they turn around and they go 0-2, they're putting themselves in trouble as well. So no, starting 0-2 is not a good thing to do in the NFL.
Okay, Shep, thank you so much. As always, enjoy the weekend's action. We will check in with you next week. That is all we have time for this evening. We'll be back tomorrow with Jane Mangan on racing. Ali Miller will be previewing the Ireland women's rugby game against Italy, and we'll have Alan Colley and Fergal Brennan with all of your football. Graham Smith is in for Tara Kumar.
Live across the nation, this is RTE 2FM.